Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Internet Report's Pulse Update, the bi-weekly podcast where we discuss what's up, what's down, what's working and not working, and generally keep our finger on the pulse of how the internet is holding up. This week, we're discussing outages at OneLogin, GitLab, Cloudflare and Workday. And I'm Barry Collins, and I'll be hosting today with the amazing Mike Hicks, Principal Solutions Analyst of Thousand Eyes. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing well, Barry. I'm not sure about the amazing bit, but I'm really pleased to be here. Looking forward to it.
Good to speak to you. Well, let's get straight on the show. As always, we've included the chapter links in the description below, so you can skip ahead to the section that you're most interested in. And if you haven't already, we'd love you to take a moment to like or subscribe on the buttons below. Let's get on with it. So OneLogin's had some problems, Mike. Explain what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So on October 26th, OneLogin, which is a cloud-based identity and access management provider, they experienced what we call a service disruption. Now, we call it service disruption because it manifested itself as sort of 500 errors to the users. And what this means when we see a sort of 500, it actually means that we're getting a response from the server. So, but it, service is unavailable, so we're not getting a response back. So because it's an authentication system, people then couldn't actually log on to the services that sat behind there.
And presumably when a service like OneLogin goes down, it's not just OneLogin that's affected, but all the companies it's providing authentication for.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there. We've seen this sort of a couple of times from there. And it's a necessary part of this process. You know, we want to have this sort of zero trust, this authentication process, the security comes online. But then you've obviously got this thing in front. And you can use that then to go on to other places. So you sort of log on to there, you do your single sign-on, authenticate to that one system, and then you can use the services that sit behind it. So it makes it simpler for the user to access. But then obviously the downside to that is, yeah, I potentially impacting access to all these other services behind, even though they may be up.
So why would some locations be affected and not others?
Yeah, it's a really good point. So what we have then when we're thinking about it, so yeah, again, I'm down here in Australia, bottom side of the world, connected by a bit of wet string. So if my authentication server where I'm actually coming to is somewhere in the US or somewhere in England from there, obviously I've got to travel a long way to actually get there. So that timeout, that latency is going to be impacted. So the fact then what we effectively have is we have all these systems around the outside where we're actually going to sort of log into. So, you know, almost like a CDN, so a content delivery network. But it's basically what we do is move that authentication to the edge or close to where the users are going to go to speed up that process. So what we're seeing then in some cases is where some systems get impacted and then some don't. So from a user, I'm actually authenticating to a local system here in Perth, and it's actually not sort of impacting anywhere else downstream or anywhere else in the world. And interestingly enough, then when you start to see sort of this, you can then also sort of tie it back. So in this case, we saw sort of this 500 authentication, this service unavailable. So that's telling me I can't get to the service in the back end when I actually get there. The other thing that can sometimes occur is that you can almost go to the workaround. So I talked about that authentication service being a single sign-on. So I actually go there and we go to multiple services in the back. Now, if I have the destination for my application, I can authenticate directly to that. So if I know where I'm going, I can sort of bypass it that way. So this is then also some users will be able to get on. But if everything is ultimately directed through there, you're still secure. You still log on authenticate to it. I just don't have this single sign-on perspective. Now, some systems allow that, some don't. So it really sort of depends on how you've set the environment up.
And I understand you saw some packet loss as a sort of secondary symptom of the recovery from this outage. Why might that occur?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what we saw is the packet loss occurred after, as the system's coming back up. So this is, you know, this could be down to a number of things. So as we're sort of bringing this system up, remember we had these 500 errors, so we're having service unavailable, which tells us that we talked about the network connectivity to the front end is actually okay. So when we're going through this process of actually maybe rebooting the service or bringing it back up or whatever process was actually taking place to roll back whatever happened there, then we might have this situation where in the meantime, it actually does disappear. So I've actually got rid of my services and available, but then when I start to go to connect into the back end, this is when I start to see this loss rate. So I see a loss rate occurring from there. Now, typically loss is what we call a leading indicator anyway. So if I'm looking at loss, it's going to be the leading indicator that I have these network problems there. So again, now I know I've got connectivity, I'm going through, I have some sort of availability, but I'm seeing some degradation as the system comes back up. It could have also been caused, you know, with people sort of everybody hitting it at the same time. So then we start to come in and then everybody starts to go back at that moment in time, and therefore then I sort of get sort of choke situations or overload situations, and then that back forwards there, and then I start to get this loss rate seen there as well.
So Mike, GitLab's also faced a recent outage. Explain what happened there, please.
Yeah, another really interesting one there. So and what we're looking at here is, again, is something sort of within the back end. So it was on October the 30th, GitLab, they're affected by availability issues, and we're sort of quite specific about availability issues. So this went on for like almost 3 hours. And what it transpired was is actually due to an increased load on the underlying database infrastructure. So, you know, what we have is a front end, the front door, as it were, for the application, and sort of residing behind the microservices, then you have sort of the databases there where the repositories are put, where we got there. And what happened was the database itself became saturated by what they said was a large increase in the bulk import jobs. So what GitLab were able then to do was sort of temporarily disable that bulk import functionality, and then it sort of had to wait for the queue jobs to run. But what it had this impact of doing when it was actually occurring there was, again, remembering we could actually get to it, so I had network connectivity, was fine, I could reach the front door, but basically, there was no one home when I actually went behind, so I actually couldn't get to the service there.
And the mitigation, as you said, seemed to involve removing access to this bulk upload feature. Is that something where you feel it just needed a bit more testing before it was rolled out, or could there be some malicious attack going on there?
Yeah, we'd probably avoid the malicious attack because, again, we were talking about stuff in the back end there. So, you know, normally that's going to occur when we sort of hit the front end. So, you know, thinking of things like DDoS attacks where we sort of deny that service coming in into the front. As to whether more testing, I suspect they actually did it. But what often happens is you get these situations of, you know, what we refer to sometimes as podcasts as the perfect storm, sort of things coming together. I mean, a few years ago, GitLab had an issue where they had another problem with the database where something sort of just it physically disappeared, but there's the situation that can occur when you're doing this. You can't necessarily test for every scenario. So what you do, basically, you test to the insertion. Now, what you need to be able to do is you need to be able to identify when something does go wrong as quickly as you can. So, you know, if I can test that whole transaction, and when I'm talking about transaction, I'm talking about actioning a whole process. So, you know, logging onto the system, not just making sure the front door's up and someone answers it, but someone answers it and therefore then I can get into the back end. Now, if I understand those dependencies and those processes in there, then yeah, obviously I have my testing that goes on, but I have this proactive perspective of what's occurring there. So then if I start to see at any one, if I think of that service delivery chain as sort of breaking into components, I get to the front door, someone answers it, those are two separate functions, then I can actually get into that backend database. That's a third function there. If I have the ability then to sort of be able to see that breakdown of where it is, I can quickly understand what's occurring. All right, I have a problem on the database, and I can actually then point specifically to that. When we looked at this one, sort of it was sort of almost out for sort of 3 hours is what they said there. So, and part of that would have been this situation. I'm based on that, they actually relocated it reasonably quickly. But then what happens is because we have to process all those jobs, so they can't go away, those bulk insertions have to happen at some point. So we need to sort of queue them. So, you know, it's the old caught into a pint pot, I need to then to be able to sort of come back. So there, what sometimes then happens is that even though I identify it quickly, the time to remediation or mitigation or remediation is sort of extended as we clear the backlog, as it were.
And if there's one group of people you don't want to upset, it's developers. I bet they all had potential solutions to that outage, right?
Absolutely. Everyone does. And everyone will be different and everyone will say the previous one wasn't as good as theirs.
We've also seen a recent outage at Cloudflare, Mike. Can you tell us what happened there?
So this occurred on sort of November the 2nd. What it transpired to be, again, was there was this service outage, basically. So people actually couldn't get to using a number of services on Cloudflare, but it also then started to roll into Workday as well. And they both experienced these service outages around the same time. There was an overlap in the timing there, and this is why I'm sort of tying them together, because when we actually started to look into this, both of them initially attributed to the issues to data center power failures. So the immediate question was, were these two incidents related? Again, looking at sort of times across there, and we can actually see when we go into the post-mortems from both of them, is that, and sort of data that we're able to see from there, that everything we actually looked at in terms of where the problem was, the nodes were exhibiting the outage or the disruption conditions, were in the same location, so both in Oregon. And then what actually then came out was we actually saw through the postmortems that came through there that there was regional power issues that are impacting a sort of an area there where the data centers were sort of located, or colo facilities were actually located.
It was a really impressive post-mortem that Cloudflare put out. Do you think more companies should be that descriptive, that honest about what happens when faults occur?
Yeah, it'd be nice. I mean, Cloudflare do a great job. They do it all the time. They put out some beautiful post-mortems, as it were, to go through the details there. I guess there's sort of two elements to this, and it really comes down to what it is you need to reveal around from there. So what they were going, when they went through, they were very candid, they were able to say sort of the details. And traditionally, Cloudflare are very good at actually putting this out. But if I'm actually dealing with another system, there's something sort of going wrong in there that, yeah, obviously for some legal concern, or I'm going to expose some vulnerability, then maybe all I need to be able to say is this is what's going on here. To the point is, what we don't want to see is there's an outage occurring, we know, or disruptions occurring, I know it's we know it's occurring, we're working on it. Right? That doesn't help anybody. So one of the analogies I use quite a lot is that we have sort of power issues that down here where I live from there. And in the early days, the power utility company used to just come out and say, there's a power outage in your area, and they'd have this huge area sort of spread out from there. Now, what they started to do now is to say, there's a power outage, estimated restoration time. Now, what that enables me to do is to not be so angry with them, because I know something's happening. There's nothing I can do, and I can take the steps to sort of work around there. So what you need to be able to do is, as much as it's great for these organizations to come out and tell us what's happening, the onus of basically is from a responsibility perspective, is to understand what components are there, and then you can effectively, if you can visualize that service delivery chain, you can effectively then sort of tie those status pages together, sort of virtually. You know, I can go, all right, this leads to this, leads to this, then you start to see the dependencies. So the more information we get from these guys, that's great, but really the responsibility lies with the you as a user to try and understand specifically what dependencies and everything made up together.
In Cloudflare's post-mortem, they had this beautiful phrase. They said they experienced a thunder and hurt problem where the API calls that have been failing overwhelmed our services. Can you just give us a bit of an explanation about what that thunder and hurt means?
Thunder and hurt is great phrasing there, isn't it? So it came through. I'm not sure that's a real word, but great phrasing, I probably should say. So it's what they're implying there. And again, it's back to our, you know, caught into a pint pot type of scenario. So all of a sudden things come back on. And if you think about what an API is doing, so an API is basically making a call to a microservice, which is then going to instigate some sort of back-end program. So if I'm thinking about a service that, let's consider something, we're making an inventory system. So I might have an API call that actually goes and checks a stock. I then got a second API call that goes and sort of takes the payment, another one that gives the receipt. So what happens when this everything came back online is I got all these people asking questions at once. And what happens in there and in Cloudflare's perspective is they have what's called an API gateway. And, you know, again, this is on coming back to my court into a pint pot. I've got all this stuff trying to get through at once. So this thundering herd of requests coming in because everything had effectively been sort of bottled up and I needed to be able to do this. So again, this starts to overwhelm the servers when it comes online. And this can then sort of have issues. So basically I'm filling buffers, I'm starting to queue things, and there's only a finite time I can hold them in the buffers, so things get dropped. And then the request comes again. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, basically, where I sort of increases and sort of rolls up through there. So what we have to do is you have to sort of, you know, step it back, bring different systems back online so we can actually get them almost in a stage process.
And there's almost nothing companies can do about that kind of thing, is there? Is that once the service has gone out for a bit, there's always going to be this rush of people trying to get back online the moment it comes back up. It's difficult to manage that kind of situation for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. You know, we talk about this concept. You can only plan for a certain amount of things. Now, how far do you go? Do you have a risk or a backup plan for a backup plan for a backup plan for a backup plan? It becomes, you know, sort of irrelevant. And nobody's going to design their system for these, you know, rare occurrences where we have this system. So what you need to do in those situations, or what they do do in those situations, and this is what happened, is then they start to do this stage process where it comes back up. You know, so because it's a question of, yes, you could design my architecture for the extreme, but that's not cost effective, you know, because that's either got costs got to be passed on, or it just, you know, I just won't make any money because it costs me too much money to run that service. So what you do is, I say, then you understand it's happening and you have your plans in place. And this is interesting as well, because also what occurs is, if we're talking about it from a power situation, if you think about when a power goes out to somewhere, and again, sort of I get this down here, is that if my power goes out and I had the air conditioning going at the same time, when the power comes back on, something inevitably trips out because I have this, yeah, this situation where I've suddenly got this huge load on the system, you know, because everything comes back on once. And this is the same that happens within these data centers when you have a power outage. So what they have to then be able to do, and it gets really sophisticated, is to understand the power distribution, understand what racks need to be put on, where my dependencies are, and how I can bring those back online. So you get this stage process as well. So while in some instances, you know, when I turn my API gateway back on, or gateways back on, I'm, you know, this gets that bottleneck coming into there. But the back end services can be brought on stage. So I'm not going to have a situation where I'm going to go up and down, trying to get the power. Because the situation is, when my power goes out and things shut down ungracefully, as we say, that can cause a whole set of other problems. You know, we sort of corrupt things as we go through, and then bringing it back up takes a longer process. So if I understand that and I don't want to have this issue situation again, you know, because it can also happen when I cut over from a gen set. So I cut over from a power supply, a backup power supply back to my main one. All of a sudden I'm bringing so much stuff on load, doof, I can have this situation again.
So, as you mentioned earlier, Workday was also affected by this power outage at the Oregon facility. Tell us what you saw with that particular outage and the data you saw from the ThousandEyes platform.
So, yeah, Barry, what I want to do is I want to show you what we saw, how we saw that data, how it manifests itself within ThousandEyes. So, again, so for those of you sort of listening on the audio-only version, what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to go into the ThousandEyes platform and here sort of talk you through, and I'll try and do as best I can to actually sort of tell you what I'm actually seeing on the screen here rather than just sort of pointing and clicking. And so for those of you who are not familiar with ThousandEyes, what it is, it's a SaaS platform that has multiple vantage points around the globe. And therefore, by actually taking these synthetic tests, we're able to sort of put that data together to understand situations like this, where we can actually see what's happening and where the performance degradation or the outage is actually occurring from there. So what I'm looking at here is I'm actually looking at a test where I'm actually, want to see the page load test. So this is actually going to a Workday page. And the reason I want to do the page load is because what I actually want to see is actually logging onto the system. So there's a couple of things I've done here. So first of all, I've actually isolated this down to the Portland or the Oregon agent there. So I'm actually looking from that environment there. And then what we can see here is I'm looking at HTTP. So what I want to see there is I actually want to see what it occurs at that, if you talk to about that layer 4. And I can see straight away where my outage occurred. So I can actually start to see the degradation there. So that's unavailable at that moment in time. But what really gets kind of cool then is we actually start to look and see what happened that from a page load perspective. And when we're looking at a page load, what we're talking about here is we're talking about sort of the time it was to actually load the page. So that detail you see on your screen to render. So if I just look at the HTTP perspective, I actually sort of see that unavailable at that moment in time. But then what confounds me, I actually see that when I go to the page load perspective, it looks like to me the page is actually loading. I don't see too much occurring there. So I can see in this swim lane underneath. So if I'm looking at the top timeline, what I'm actually looking at there, I'm actually looking at the average page load time in the top, the light blue, so that the major figure there that shows me they were sort of averaging around 975 milliseconds around it, which is pretty good. I see some odd peaks there. But again, looking specifically at the Oregon one, I'm looking at this 639. So straight away, it tells me a couple of things. It tells me that if I'm looking from that particular agent, that my page load time is less. So I can sort of see what happens from there. But again, remember, I've said I've got unavailability, but what I'm actually doing is I'm seeing the page. So to actually then see what's occurring, if I'm actually looking at this from within the system itself, so what I've done now, I've gone in to look at what we call a waterfall diagram. So from here, what I can actually start to see is I can actually see sort of how that page actually built. And interestingly enough, when I start to see, so I see my login occurring here,
And what I actually then see, so the top of the page there, I see the login occurring, and then I'm actually doing what's called a redirect. So an HTTP 302, I see a redirect from there, I see all those times. But then it looks like it's loading a page. But if I actually come down, what I actually see there is I'm seeing static information. So my domain has changed. I'm actually going to the static community there at Workday. And if I actually come down to the bottom there, what I actually see right down the bottom somewhere is this little tools icon here. And if I was actually click on that and show me that was, that shows me the spanner. So that's the splash screen that was actually coming up during that time. So straight away, if I'm actually looking at that, that tells me, okay, this is why I was unavailable, because the system itself was unavailable, but I redirected to another location, which was basically giving me a test card. So look and see what sort was on there. So static content. Now, just to contrast that, if I actually go back before the outage occurred, what I actually see here is this is completely different. So this is going for login process. So interestingly here, I actually see a 307. Now, the difference between a 302 and a 307 is a 302 is still, both those are redirects. So anything to 300 is some sort of redirect. But a 307 is a temporary redirect. So I'm actually directing it to an available backend system that's there. So this is a nice way of actually doing it to so I can actually have flexibility in the back, so I'm not having these single points in there. So straight away, I'm actually looking somewhere different. So I can see sort of the two redirects there, but then I start to load the page. I can see coming through there. But interestingly, what you look at here, the provider I'm seeing there is actually Cloudflare. So this is where I'm actually going into Cloudflare environment. In this case, the system was loading. Again, I'll just jump back in to show you that sort of contrast. So straight away here, I'm going to static. And now I'm actually looking at it. I'm looking specifically here. It's going to Amazon as the provider there. So these are my sort of two clues to tell me what's going on. The other thing interesting that is that because they actually sort of did this during the outage situation, so when I was actually there, or the disruption situation, normally, remember we talked about when we were looking at it prior, we talked about the 500 errors. So again, I told you that was indication that was some sort of back-end system problem because I'd actually, or issue, because I was actually getting a response from the server. So 500 server-side status code would come back and tell me some sort of message, i.e. the service is unavailable, it's a bad gateway, or whatever it is from down here. Now, a good response is a 200 okay. And this is what I see here, even though the system is down. So the only way I'm actually going to look at that is to actually look in context to be able to say, okay, where is it actually going to and what is the contents in there? And that's where that waterfall becomes really useful to me to be able to understand and see what's occurring.
So what those graphs are basically showing you is that the one incident affected both companies, and that we see in Workday being affected by Cloudflare's outage on almost a secondary basis because they're using their services and then having to fall back on Amazon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It got kind of hit, unfortunately, got hit for a 2-to-1. Now, you know, you can sort of build in his redundancy, but the way things are architected around it, and they do have redundant features. So everybody builds in his redundancy in the environment. So a lot of effort goes into architecting these. But in some ways, when you're trying to build it and you have these systems, you inevitably, from an application perspective, have essentially these points where they become these single aggregation points. And unfortunately, these guys had this situation where they appeared to sort of coincide. So you say got hit for a 2-for-1.
And we always regard the internet as this sort of great, infallible mass of redundant systems. But here we've got a case where one outage at one location in Oregon has caused, you know, disruption to two big companies here, possibly more. Sometimes the internet's not quite as infallible as we think, is it, Mike?
Yeah, there's a good point. I mean, the internet is this sort of this multifaceted beast that's put together. The one thing I will say is we're talking here specifically, and it's interesting because we roll both things together. But what we're also talking about here is an application issue. And like I said, when I'm actually starting to host that, I because of even for doing high availability architecture, there's instances where I'm going to have single dependencies or dependencies that I'm not aware of that need to that become these single aggregation points around there. If I'm thinking of that from the network connectivity, it's pretty resilient. It appears to be, what it was originally designed for and how it's put together. And if you think about the many autonomous systems that all make up this internet connectivity and these peering relationship as we pass stuff around there, there's sort of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dynamic paths that I can sort of take. Obviously, if I start to come back to my local point, this is where I have this aggregation. So if I have a local last mile issue, we've seen in the past where there's these situations where fibers have been cut, which has sort of taken down a particular local area. And sort of that impacts one particular region. And then, but if I'm actually thinking, am I starting to go into my transit providers, am I going into my, my network backbone as itself there, then potentially, because of the way the peering works, I can sort of route around it dynamically. And this is what it's designed to do. Where that sort of comes back, as I said, is where we're going to have these single aggregation points or these points of single dependencies or that, that, you know, is critical to do. And how they manifest themselves is kind of interesting as well. You know, we have an outage, it's down, I can't get connectivity, there's a network issue, I can see that quite clearly. You know, like I said, it might dynamically route around there. What happens when I have these situations as we had here is what it is that everything appears to be working. I can get to the front door. In some instances, I can load a screen. Some are very good, like Workday, which will tell me there's an error going on, there's a problem here, we're working on it, or whatever the maintenance screen actually said when it came up there. It also, when these occur at these single dependency points, it also seems to have a larger impact zone, a larger footprint, as it were, because lots of people are sort of relying on it.
So it's time to look at the numbers, Mike, and what have you seen in the outages data over the past fortnight?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually love this part, the numbers, because it essentially is this patterns. I'm big on patterns as we go through there. So what we've actually seen sort of between October 23rd, November the 5th, we actually saw the number of outages, total global outages, sort of fluctuate quite significantly. So during that first week, so October 23rd to 29th, the number of outages sort of increased from 163 to 221. So, you know, we're looking at somewhere in the region of a 36% rise, which when we compare that to the previous week. However, the following week, we actually saw a 25% decrease in outages, which sort of dropped from 221 to 165. This is a pattern we started to see as we come out of the Northern Hemisphere summer. We start to see sort of the outages sort of increase as we go up towards the end of the year there. And if we looked at that from then the US perspective, we sort of saw similar patterns, you know, where they rose initially from 75 to 103 during that October 23rd to 29th. Again, very similar because it was a 37% increase. But again, the following week, they actually decreased sort of 103 to 84, which is an 18% drop from the previous week.
Outages tend to increase at this time of year once the Northern Hemisphere comes out of summer. Why is that, Mike?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. It's a pattern we've seen sort of year over year. We see these, you know, it sort of decreases at the bit, or we see a lower level at the start of the year, sort of January as we're coming out of a holiday period. It rises up to the summer, then it sort of drops down again. And then again, as we come out of the summer, as we're seeing now, we see these number of outages actually rise. Now, when we're thinking about an outage, we're thinking about it as this 100% packet loss. So we'll see that. Talked about loss being a leading indicator. That's what we're actually doing to sort of see this, to see the outages there. Now, if I then isolate those further, and we can look at those from a regional perspective, what I actually see when I go in to look at those, I can actually isolate them down to time of day. And when we look at the outages that are occurring in these, let's call them these peak periods, these off-season periods, so these off-holiday periods, what we actually be able to do is we're able to, in some cases, we can actually tie these down directly to maintenance events. So maintenance schedule, maintenance that comes out from a provider will actually sort of document it, and they'll say it's going to hit there. And they'll normally do that if they think the change they're going to make is going to have a noticeable impact and potentially be a customer impact or user impacting from there. So they'll announce it, and we can sort of tie those two together there. But what we then can see is we can take from that and we can use that pattern to identify these other ones. So what we're saying there is they do occur outside of a business hours from a region perspective. So if I'm looking at something that's occurring within the Southern Hemisphere down here, you know, it will occur outside the 9 to 5. And they typically occur sort of 1 or 2 in the morning, local time, relevant to where they are there. And what that then tells us, and they occur on the hour, right? So you see a change window is put in and we can sort of see those. So what we do in those cases, we can say, all right, the likelihood of that is it's very likely to actually be a maintenance event. So although it's an outage, you know, it gets recorded as an outage, this is what it is, and it may have been user impacting, but they've actually taken steps to sort of reduce any level of impact to the customer by doing it out of hours from there. And then the resilience we have in the internet as well. But the next part to that then is why are we starting to see these numbers increase? So we're saying, if I think about these holiday periods, we're now relying on the internet as the backbone for not just our social life, not just to stream to soccer or to stream movies down there, but businesses are relying on the internet. So it is all our applications and SaaS across from there. So what you don't want to do is during these periods of time, you don't want to have to be out sort of fixing it because things are relying on it. So, you know, sort of e-commerce, all this stuff is relying on this internet and there. So I almost get to this situation where I want to do a do no harm during this period of time. So therefore, I want to do all my work off season, as it were. So this is then why we start to see these patterns and then why we see the drop off again. So over the summer period, although people may be on vacation or starting to do that, again, I don't want to be able to sort of doing this where I'm going to cause mass disruption during this period of time. So I have to, I want to go into this period where, like I say, I'm doing this, do no harm. You sort of see similar things occurring as we sort of get into key days. So, just down here in Australia recently, we've had the Melbourne Cup. There's a software freeze that goes on down here. So the Melbourne Cup is a horse race that goes on there. You see a software freeze for a lot of some organisations there because this is their biggest day of the year. They don't want to have to sort of do changes. And it's the same for my my provider. Now, I'm still going to have these glitches that take place. I'm still going to have network outages that occur during this period. But typically, when we actually look at those, they're of a shorter duration and they tend to be, you can see, sort of automated restoration. Obviously, you still get the major ones, and this is there where you need that visibility, but you're going to get these little automated ones that occur. You can sort of see these blips occurring during the time. So really, yeah, it's a very long story to say this is why I believe that the outages sort of start to increase outside these holiday periods.
I love the fact you blamed a horse race for increasing the outages. I think that's a highlight of my week.
Absolutely. You've got a lot of country that stops for a horse race.
Well, it's been great speaking to you, Mike, and that's our show for this week. Please like and subscribe because we really appreciate it. And not only does it ensure that you get a notification for each new show, but it also helps us shape the content of the show. You can follow us on X at Thousand Eyes or send us your questions or feedback to internetreport@thousandeyes.com. Until next time, goodbye.